in her head, colliding, each new idea interrupting the last. Part of her is trying to put together why Bill came. Another part is parsing through what he said, specifically about Scott. What is she supposed to think? That the man who saved her nephew actually crashed the plane somehow and then faked his heroic swim? Every idea in that sentence is absurd in its own right. How does a painter crash a plane, and why? And what did he mean about Scott's relationship with Maggie? Was he saying there was an affair? And why drive out to the house to tell her this? The boy taps her arm and points to his pants. "You have to go potty?" she asks. He nods, and she picks him up and carries him to the public bathroom. As she helps him with his pants, it hits her with a sway of vertigo that, given his youth, there is little chance he will remember his real parents when he's an adult. She will be the mother he thinks of the second Sunday of every May. Not her sister. But, she thinks, does that mean that Doug will be his father? The thought of it sickens her a little. Not for the first time, she curses herself for the weakness of her youth, this need for constant companionship, like an elderly widow who leaves the TV on and gets a dog. But then she thinks maybe all Doug needs is a chance. Maybe inheriting a 4-year-old boy will motivate him, turn him into a family man. Then again, isn't thinking a child can save your marriage the classic delusion? They've had JJ with them for 2 weeks now, and Doug isn't drinking any less, hasn't changed his comings and goings, hasn't treated her any better. Her sister is dead, and the boy is now an orphan, but what about Doug's needs, he says with every thoughtless comment. What about how this affects him? She helps JJ get his pants up and wash his hands. Uncertainty is making her lightheaded. Maybe she's not being fair. Maybe she's still upset about meeting the estate attorneys and business managers, the finality of the thing. And maybe Doug's right. Maybe they should move into the house in the city, give JJ a sense of continuity, use the money to recreate the luxury he knows. But her instinct is that that would only confuse him. Everything has changed. To pretend otherwise feels like fraud. "Ice cream?" she asks him as they walk back outside and the full heat of the day hits him. He nods. She smiles and takes his hand, leading him to the car. Tonight she will talk to Doug, lay it all out, how she's feeling, what she thinks the boy needs. They will sell the real estate and put the money into the trust. They will give themselves a monthly stipend that's big enough to cover any additional expenses the boy brings, but not enough to allow them to quit their jobs or become people of luxury. Doug won't like it, she knows. But what can he say? The decision is hers. Rachel Bateman, July 9th, 2006 to August 23rd, 2015. She remembered none of it. What details she knew had been told to her, except for the image of a rocking chair in a bald, bare attic, rocking back and forth on its own. She saw that chair from time to time in her mind, mostly in the ether on the verge of sleep, an old wicker rocker creaking toward and away, as if to soothe a ghost, dog-tired and cross. Her parents named her Rachel after Maggie's grandmother. When she was really little, she was 9 now, Rachel decided she was a cat. She studied their cat Peaches, trying to move like it. She would sit at the breakfast table and lick the back of her hand, wiping her face with it after. Her parents put up with it until she told them she was going to sleep during the day and roam the house at night. Maggie, her mother, said, "Babe, I just don't have the energy to stay up." Rachel was the reason they had bodyguards, the reason men with Israeli accents and shoulder holsters followed them everywhere. There were 3, normally. In the lingo of the business, Gil, the first, was a body man, paid to stay in direct physical proximity to the principal. In addition, there was an advance team, usually rotating, of 4 to 6 men who watched them from farther away. Rachel knew they were here because of her, because of what had happened, though her father denied it. threats, he said vaguely, implying that running a TV news network was somehow more relevant to their daily threat level than the fact that his daughter had been kidnapped in her youth, and that quite possibly one or more of the kidnappers were still out there. At least, those were the facts in her head. Her parents had assured her, as had men from the FBI, as a favor to her father last year, and a high-paid child psychiatrist, that the kidnapping had been the work of a single deranged man, Wayne R. Macy, 36, and that Macy had been killed, shot through the right eye, during the ransom exchange by a lawman in a flak jacket. But not before Macy had shot and killed a second lawman in the opening salvo of a fleeting firefight. The dead lawman was Mick Daniels, 44, a former FBI agent and veteran of the First Gulf War. All she remembered was a chair. She was supposed to feel things. She knew that. A 9-year-old girl in summer, on the verge of her teen years, she had been out on the vineyard with her mother and brother for the last 2 weeks, lying about. As a child of great wealth, there were countless options available to her. Tennis lessons, sailing lessons, golf lessons, horseback riding, whatever. But she didn't feel like being trained. She had studied piano for 2 years, but ultimately wondered to what end and moved on. She liked being home with her mom and her brother. That was basically it. She felt useful there. A 4-year-old boy is more than a handful, her mother would say, and so Rachel played with JJ. She fixed him lunch and changed his pants when he had an accident. Her mother told her she didn't have to do it, that she should go out, enjoy the day, but it was hard to do with a large Israeli man, 3 sometimes, following your every move. Not that she could argue the need for it. Wasn't she herself proof that you can't be too careful? So she stayed home, lying on the porch or the back lawn, staring at the ocean, blinded by it sometimes, that diamond sparkle. She liked to read books about wayward girls, girls who fit in nowhere, then discovered they had magic powers. Hermione, Katniss Everdeen. She'd read Harriet the Spy when she was 7 and Pippi Longstocking, and they were competent, but in the end, simply human. As she grew, Rachel felt she needed more from her heroines, more teeth, more fight, more power. She liked the thrill of danger they faced, but didn't want to have to actually worry about them. It made her too anxious. Whenever she reached a particularly distressing section, Hermione versus the troll in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, for example, she would walk the book inside and hand it to her mother. "What's this? Just tell me, does she make it?" "Does who make what?" "Hermione. A troll escaped, a giant, and she's... Can you... Just read it and tell me she's okay." And her mother, who knew her well enough not to push, would stop whatever she was doing and sit, reading as many pages as it took to get the answer. Then she would hand the book back, her thumb marking a new spot. "Start here," she'd say. She didn't have to fight it. She just yelled at it that it was in the girl's bathroom and should go away. They had a giggle about that, yelling at a troll, and then Rachel went back outside to read. It started with the housekeeper. They didn't realize it, though, at the time. Her name was Francesca Butler, but everyone called her Frankie. This was when the family summered on Long Island, at Montauk Point, before private planes and helicopters, when they would just pile in the car and drive out on a Friday night, battling the shifting bulge, like the LIE was just a giant anaconda that had swallowed a traffic jam, the clot of snarled cars shifting downward in surges. Her brother wasn't even an idea yet. It was just David and Maggie and toddler Rachel sleeping in her car seat. The news channel was 6 years old and already a profit and controversy-generating machine, but her father liked to say, "I'm just a figurehead, a general in a back room. Nobody knows me from Adam." The kidnapping would change that. That was the summer of the Montauk Monster, which washed up on shore on July 12, 2008. A local woman, Jenna Hewitt, and 3 of her friends were walking on Ditch Plains Beach and found the creature.
"We were looking for a place to sit,"
she was later quoted saying. When we saw some people looking at something, we didn't know what it was. We joked that maybe it was something from Plum Island. Described by some as a rodent-like creature with a dinosaur beak, the monster was about the size of a small dog and mostly hairless. The body was stocky and the limbs slender. It had two front paws with elongated pale claws. Its tail was slim and approximately equal in length to the head and neck combined. It was short-faced, wearing an expression of agony or dismay. The post-orbital part of the skull appeared long and stout. It had no teeth visible in the upper jaw, instead showing what could be described as a hooked beak of bone. The lower jaw contained a large pointed canine and four post-canines with tall, conical cusps. Was it a raccoon, as some suggested, that had decomposed in the ocean? A sea turtle whose shell had been removed? A dog? For weeks, photos of the bloated, distended corpse appeared in tabloids and online. Speculation increased that it was something cooked up in a lab at the Plum Island Animal Disease Center, a mile or so offshore. The real island of Dr. Moreau, they started calling it. But eventually, as with all things, a lack of answers led to a lack of interest, and the world moved on. But when David and Maggie arrived in Montauk that weekend, monster fever was full-blown. Roadside T-shirt kiosks had sprung up. For $5, you could see the spot where the monster was found, now just an anonymous patch of sand. The Batemans were renting a house on Tuthill Road. It was a two-story white clapboard across the road from a small lagoon. Mostly secluded, the house was directly parallel to a stalled modern remodel, sheet plastic flapping over a gaping wound to the living room. In years prior, Rachel's family had rented a house farther north on Pine Tree Drive, but that one had sold to a hedge fund billionaire in January. Their new clapboard home, Maggie would stay out there with Rachel through Labor Day weekend and David would drive out on Fridays and take off the last week of August, was cozy and quaint. It had a large farmhouse kitchen and a sloped and creaky porch. The bedrooms were on the second floor, Mom and Dad facing the ocean. Rachel's room, complete with a Victorian-era crib, faced the lagoon. They brought Frankie, the nanny, with them, a third pair of hands, as Maggie liked to say. Frankie sat in the back of the Audi with Rachel, engaged in a road-trip-long game of pick up Rachel's pacifier, wipe it off, and hand it back. Frankie was a night school nursing student at Fordham who helped take care of Rachel 3 days a week. She was 22, an émigré from the wilds of Michigan who moved to New York with a boyfriend after college, only to have him leave her for the bass player in a Japanese surf punk band. Maggie liked her, because spending time with Frankie made her feel young, something that being with David in his world, populated entirely by people like David in their 40s and some even in their 50s and 60s, did not. Maggie had just turned 29. She and Frankie were 7 years apart. The only difference between them, really, was that Maggie had married a millionaire.
"You got lucky," Frankie used to tell her. "He's nice," Maggie would say.
"So, even luckier," Frankie would say and smile.
Among her friends, there was a lot of talk about landing a rich man. They used to put on short skirts and tall boots and go to bottle service clubs, hoping to land a Wall Street up-and-comer with a full head of hair and a dick of steel. But Frankie wasn't really like that. She had a softer edge, having been raised with goats and chickens. Maggie never worried that Frankie was out to steal her husband away. It would be absurd, after all, to trade in your 29-year-old trophy wife for a 22-year-old, like a cliché on steroids. And yet she supposed stranger things had happened. Just a few years earlier, she had been the one paid to teach other people's children, a 22-year-old preschool teacher living in Brooklyn. She rode her bike over the Brooklyn Bridge every morning, using hand signals like she was supposed to. The foot traffic on the bridge was minimal at that hour, joggers mostly, a few health-conscious commuters brown-bagging their way across the river. She wore a lemon-yellow helmet, her long brown hair fluttering behind her like a cape. She didn't wear headphones or sunglasses. She braked for squirrels, stopping mid-span to take in the view and have some water.
In the city, she took Chambers to Hudson and rode north, checking behind her every minute or so for taxi drivers on cell phones or slicksters in German automobiles who'd stopped looking at the road. She got to work every morning by 6:30. She liked to straighten up before the kids arrived to restock supplies. The schoolhouse was small, just a few rooms in an old brick building next to a parking lot that had been turned into a playground. It was on a tree-lined street in a part of the West Village that had an almost old London feel. Sidewalks curved like crooked fingers. On Facebook, she once posted that she liked this part of the city best, its timeless, genteel nature. The rest of the city felt too cold to her. Wide avenues of windy business towers like gleaming bank machines of human resource. The first student usually arrived at 8, strolling or shuffling or scootering, hand in hand with daddy or mama, sometimes still half asleep, lying in a futuristic McLaren or Stuka supercarriage. Little Penelope or Daniel or Eloise, shoes so small they could fit on a doll, tiny short-sleeved shirts with checks or stripes, like one day they would grow up to be wealthy nerds just like Daddy. 4-year-old girls in $80 dresses with one pigtail or flowers in their hair picked from a pot outside a brownstone by a harried parent on the way to school. Maggie was always there to greet them, standing in the asphalt playground, smiling with sunny exuberance as soon as they appeared, like a dog who jumps to its feet at the sound of a key in the front door.
"Good morning, Miss Maggie," they cried.
"Good morning, Dieter."
"Good morning, Justin."
"Good morning, Sadie." She gave them a hug or mussed their hair, then said good morning to Mommy or Daddy, who often grunted their replies, having started texting the moment their kids' feet touched school property. They were lawyers and advertising executives, magazine editors and architects. The men were 40 or older. The oldest father in her class was 63. The women ranged from late-20s supermodels with children named Raisin or Mudge to harried working moms in their 30s who had given up on finding a living, breathing husband and convinced a gay friend to come in a cup in exchange for 6 weekends a year at the summer house in the Catskills and the honorary title of uncle. She was a patient teacher. Sometimes inhumanly so, warm and thoughtful, but firm when necessary. In their evaluations, some parents wrote that they wished they could be more like her, a 22-year-old girl who always had a smile and a kind word, even to a screaming child who had just screwed their nap. Maggie usually left the school around 4, walking her mahogany-colored bike to the curb before snapping her chin strap and lurching into traffic. In the afternoons, she liked to ride over to the river and take the bike path south. She stopped sometimes to sit on a bench by the water and watch boat traffic, the helmet forgotten atop her head. She would close her eyes every time the wind blew. On days when the temperature was over 90, she might buy a shaved ice from a Mexican man with a cart, usually cherry, and sit in the grass eating it with the flat thumbnail of a tiny spoon. On those days, she would take off her helmet and lay it on the grass like a lemon drop. She'd relax on her back in the cool green and stare at the clouds for a long time, flexing her toes on the lawn, before reaffixing her helmet and starting the long ride home, her lips stained the color of childhood. How distant it seemed to her now, just 7 years later, the unemployed mother of a toddler, or more precisely, the pampered wife of a millionaire. As soon as they arrived at the house, she and David would go to the market and stock up on supplies, while Frankie stayed home with Rachel. Montauk at this point wasn't the brand name scene of the Hamptons, but she could feel it creeping in. The local general store now sold specialty butters and artisanal jams. The old hardware store stocked heirloom linens and had been remodeled in distressed white beadboard. From a roadside stand, they bought tomatoes, fat and cracked, and went home and sliced them thick and ate them with sea salt and olive oil. There was no such thing as hardship anymore, certainly nothing more than a fleeting inconvenience. And yet, when she reflected on it late at night, Maggie was amazed by how her sense of life's difficulties ebbed and adapted to fit her new circumstances. whereas before David, she would have to bike home in the rain some days through gridlock traffic and scour her apartment for pennies to do laundry, and even that couldn't truly be considered hardship in a world where children went to bed hungry. Now she found herself exasperated by foolish things, misplacing the keys to her Lexus, or being told by the clerk at D'Agostino that he didn't have change for 100. When she realized this, how soft she was becoming, how privileged, Maggie felt a wave of self-loathing. They should give all their money away, she told David, raise their kids hand to mouth with the proper values.
I want to go back to work, she'd say.
Okay.
No, I mean it. I can't just sit around all day. I'm a worker. I'm used to working.
You're taking care of Rachel. You tell me all the time how much work that is. She would twist the phone cord between her fingers, keeping her voice down so as not to wake the baby.
It is, I know, and I just can't. I'm not going to have my daughter raised by nannies.
I know. We both feel that way, which is why it's so magical that you can...
I don't feel like myself anymore.
That's a normal postpartum...
Don't do that. Don't make it about my body, like I can't control myself.
Silence from the other end. She couldn't tell if he was being taciturn or writing an email.
I still don't understand why you can't take more time, she said. We're only up here a month.
I hear you. It's frustrating for me, too, but we're in the middle of a big expansion on a corporate level.
Never mind, she said,
not wanting to hear the details of his job. It's not like he enjoyed her war stories, the woman who cut ahead of them at the supermarket, the playground soap operas. Okay. I'm just saying. I'm going to try to make it out Thursday night at least twice. Now it was she who was silent. Upstairs, Rachel was asleep in her crib. Maggie could hear sounds from the other side of the kitchen that made her think Frankie was changing over the laundry. On the edge of things was the sound of the ocean, that tectonic drum, the heartbeat of the earth. At night, she slept like the dead because of it, some core genetic pulse once again in phase with the rhythm of the sea. It was late the following week that Frankie disappeared. She had gone into town to see a movie at the little old art house theater. She was meant to be home by 11, and Maggie didn't wait up. It was her night with Rachel, rising at her earliest cries and soothing her back to sleep, and her instinct on those nights was always to front-load her sleep, so as soon as the sun went down, sometimes before, her head would be down on the pillow, her tired eyes perpetually reading and rereading the same short pages of her book without ever making it past the second chapter. In the morning when she rose with Rachel, who had come to bed with her just after midnight, and Frankie wasn't up, Maggie thought it was a little strange, but the girl was young, and maybe she met someone at the movie or went for a drink after at the old sailor pub on the way home. It wasn't until 11 when she knocked on Frankie's door, they'd agreed that Maggie would have the day to herself, and then opened it and found the bed empty and unused, that Maggie began to worry. She called David at the office.
What do you mean, she's gone?
He said.
Just, I don't know where she is. She didn't come home, and she's not answering her phone.
Did she leave a note?
Where would she leave a note? I checked her room in the kitchen. She went to a movie. I called her cell, but she's not...
Okay, let me... I'll make a few calls. Check to see if she came back to the city. Remember, she was having troubles with that boy, Troy something. And if I don't turn up anything, or she's still not back... I'll call the local police.
Is that... I don't want to overreact.
Well, either we're worried or we're not. You tell me.
There was a long pause while Maggie thought it through, during which time she also made a snack for Rachel, who was biting at her ankles.
Babe?
Yeah, she said. It's weird. You should call.
3 hours later, she was sitting across from the local sheriff, Jim Peabody, whose face looked like the last piece of jerky in the jar.
Maybe I'm just being silly, she said, but she's usually so responsible.
Don't do that to yourself, Mrs. Bateman. Take your power away. You know this girl, and you had an instinct. You gotta trust that.
Thank you, Thank you.
Jim turned to his deputy, female, heavyset, about 30. We'll visit the theater, talk to Sam, see if he remembers her. Grace will go by the pub. Maybe she stopped in there. You said your husband was calling her people?
Yes, he phoned some friends and some of her family. Nobody's heard from her.
Rachel was coloring, mostly on the paper, at a small, round kid's table Maggie had picked up at a flea market, the kind that came with two adorable little folding chairs. Maggie was amazed the girl hadn't bothered them once during the entire visit, as if she understood the importance of what was happening. But then she had always been a sensitive and serious child, so much so that Maggie sometimes worried she was depressed. She'd read an article about it in the Times, Children with Depression, and now it hung in the back of her mind, a big idea that could tie all the little ideas together, the poor sleeping, the shyness. Or maybe she was just allergic to wheat. This is what motherhood was, one fear eclipsed by another.
She's not depressed, David would say. She's just focused.
But he was a boy, and a Republican to boot. What did he know about the intricacies of female psychology? When there was still no word by sundown, David put the rest of the week's activities on hold and drove out. In the minutes after he arrived, Maggie felt like a balloon deflating. The strong business-as-usual facade she had put on disappeared. She poured herself and him a stiff drink.
"Rachel asleep?" he asked.
"Yes. I put her in a room. Do you think that's a mistake? Should I have put her in ours?"
He shrugged. It made no real-world difference, he thought. It was just an issue in his wife's head.
"I called the sheriff on the way in," he told her when they were sitting in the living room. The ocean roared in through the screens, invisible in the black night air. He said she definitely went to the movie. People remembered her, pretty girl dressed like the city, but nothing from the bar. So whatever happened, it happened on her way home.
I mean, what could have happened?
He shrugged, sipped his drink.
They checked the local hospitals.
Halfway through her drink, Maggie grimaced.
Shit. I should have done that. Why didn't I?
It's not your job. You were busy with Rachel. But they checked the hospitals, and no one fitting her description came in last night. No Jane Doe's or anything.
David, is she dead? Like, lying in a ditch or something?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the longer this goes, the less positive I'm going to spin it. But right now, it could just be, I don't know, a bender.
But they both knew Frankie wasn't the bender type. That night, Maggie slept fitfully. She had a dream that the Montauk Monster had come to life and was slithering out of the lagoon and across the road, moving inevitably toward their house, leaving a slug trail of gore behind. She stirred and rolled, imagining it surging up the siding to the second-floor window. Rachel's window. Had she left the window open? It was a warm night, stuffy. She usually closed it, but this time, given her absent brain, her distraction over Frankie, had she left it open? Maggie woke with her feet already on the floor, a mother's panic moving her down the short hall to her daughter's room. The first thing that struck her was that the door was closed. Maggie knew she hadn't closed it. In fact, she always put a doorstop in front of it to keep it from closing in the wind. She hit the door almost at a run, and the knob wouldn't turn. Her shoulder hit the door hard, making a loud bang. Behind her, she heard David stir, but from inside the room, she heard nothing. She tried the knob again. It was locked.
"David!"
she yelled. Then again, her voice taking on a tinge of hysteria. Then he was behind her, moving fast but still sluggish, some part of his sleeping brain left behind. "It's locked," she said.
"Move," he told her.
She did, flattening herself against the wall to let him get in there. He grabbed the knob in his big hand and tried to turn it.
"Why isn't she crying?"
Maggie heard herself say.
"She must be awake. I must have woken her up, banging."
He tried the knob again, then gave up, put his shoulder into it, once, twice, three times. The door stretched the jamb but didn't open.
"Motherfucker," he said, now fully awake, taken by fear. Why wasn't his daughter crying?
Instead, all that came under the door was the surge of the ocean. He stepped back and kicked the door hard, reaching down for some primal Neanderthal strength. The jamb shattered this time, one of the hinges popping, the door flying open and bending backward, like a boxer who's been gut-punched. Maggie pushed past him into the room and screamed. The window was wide open. The crib was empty. Maggie stood staring at it for a long time, as if the sight of an empty crib was a surreal impossibility. David ran to the window and looked out, first one way, then another. Then he was out of the room, past her. She heard his feet thundering down the stairs, then heard the front door slam, and heard his feet running through first grass, then sand, then gravel, as he made his way to the road. He was on the phone downstairs when she found him.
"Yes," he said. "This is life or death. I don't care what it costs."
A pause as he listened.
"Okay, we'll be up."
He hung up, eyes locked on some point in the middle distance.
"David?"
she said.
"They're sending someone."
"Who?"
"The company."
"What do you mean, someone? Did you call the cops?"
He shook his head.
"This is my daughter. They took my daughter. We're not using public servants."
"What are you talking about? Who took her? She's missing. We need to have someone, a lot of someone's out there looking for her right now."
He stood and started turning on lights, going room to room, making the house look awake. She followed.
"David?"
But he was lost in thought, some kind of masculine scheme playing out in his head. She turned and grabbed the car keys off the hook.
"Well, I can't just sit here."
He caught up to her at the door, grabbed her wrist.
"It's not," he said. "She didn't wander off. She's two. Someone climbed up to her window and took her. Why? For money."
"No."
"But first," he said, "first they took Frankie."
She leaned against the wall, her head spinning.
"What are you—"
He put his hands on her, not in a rough way, but firmly, to let her know she was still connected to the earth, to him.
"Frankie knows us. She knows our routines, our finances, or at least a general sense of our finances. She knows which room Rachel sleeps in, everything. They took Frankie so she could give them Rachel."
Maggie went over and sat down on the sofa, purse still on her arm.
"Unless she's working with them," said David.
Maggie shook her head, shock calming her, making her limbs feel like seaweed floating on the waves.
"She's not. She's 22. She goes to night school."
"Maybe she needs money."
"David," said Maggie, looking at him, "she's not helping them. Not on purpose." They thought about this, what it might take to compel a conscientious young woman to give up a sleeping toddler placed in her charge. 45 minutes later, they heard car tires on the driveway. David went outside to meet them. He came back in with 6 men. They were clearly armed and had what could only be described as a military demeanor. One of the men wore a suit. He was olive-skinned, graying at the temples.
"Mrs. Bateman," he said, "I'm Mick Daniels. These men are here for your protection and to help me ascertain the facts."
"I had a dream,"
she found herself telling him.
"Honey," said David.
"About the Montauk Monster. That it was sliding up the side of our house."
Mick nodded. If he found this odd at all, he didn't say so.
"You were sleeping," he told her. "But some part of you heard something. It's genetic training, an animal memory of spending a few 100,000 years as prey."
He had them show him their bedroom and then Rachel's room, had them retrace their steps. Meanwhile, 2 of his men examined the perimeter. The other 2 set up a command center in the living room, bringing in laptops, telephones, and printers. They met up again with the full group 10 minutes later.
"A single set of footprints," they were told by a black man working a piece of bubble gum, "and 2 deeper marks directly under the window. We think that's from the ladder. Tracks lead to a smaller structure on the property, then disappear. We found a ladder inside, extendable, Tall enough to reach the second floor, I think.
So, he didn't bring his own ladder, said Mick. He used one that was already here, which means he knew it was here.
We had a rain gutter fall last weekend, said David. The landlord came and put it up, used a ladder. Not sure where he got it, but he drove up in a sedan, so he didn't bring it with him.
We'll look at the landlord, said Mick.
No visible tire marks on the road, said a second man holding a rifle. Nothing fresh, at least. No sense of which direction he or they may have taken.
I'm sorry, said Maggie, but who are you people? Somebody took my baby. We need to call the police.
Mrs. Bateman, said Mick.
Stop calling me that, she said back.
I'm sorry. What would you like me to call you?
No, just... Will somebody please tell me what's happening?
Ma'am, Mick said, I'm a paid security consultant for the biggest private security firm in the world. Your husband's employer retained my services at no cost to you. I served 8 years with the Navy SEALs and 8 more with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I worked 300 kidnapping cases with a very high rate of success. There is a formula at work here. As soon as we figure it out, I promise you we will call the FBI, but not as helpless bystanders. My job is to control the situation from now until we get your daughter back.
And can you do that?
Maggie said, as if from another dimension.
Get her back?
Yes, ma'am, said Mick. I can.
Blanco. It's the white walls that wake him. Not just in the bedroom. The whole apartment is embossed in pure ivory. Walls, floors, furniture. Scott lies there, eyes open, heart beating fast. To sleep in white limbo, like a new soul suspended in ether waiting for a door to open, for the bureaucratic checkbox of body assignment, praying breathlessly for the invention of color, can drive a man mad, apparently. Scott tosses and turns under white sheets on white pillows, his bed frame painted the color of eggs. At 2:15 a.m., he throws off the covers and puts his feet on the floor. Traffic sounds creep through the double-pane windows. He is sweating from the exertion of forcing himself to stay in bed, and he can feel his heart beating through the walls of his ribcage. He goes to the kitchen and considers making coffee, but it feels wrong somehow. Night is night, and morning is morning, and to confuse the two can lead to lingering displacement. A man out of time, phase-shifted, drinking bourbon for breakfast. There is an itch behind Scott's eyes. He goes into the living room, finds a credenza, opens all the drawers. In the bathroom, he finds 6 tubes of lipstick. In the kitchen, he finds a black Sharpie and 2 highlighters, pink and yellow. There are beets in the fridge, frazzled and fat, and he takes them out and puts a pot of water on the stove to boil. They are talking about him on the television. He doesn't need to turn it on to know that. He is part of the cycle now, the endless worrying. Whitewashed floorboards creak underfoot as he pads into the living room. White. The fireplace is still charred from recent use, and Scott crouches on the cool brick lip and searches the ashes. He finds a lump of charcoal by feel, pulling it forth like a diamond from a mine. There is a floor-length mirror on the far wall, and as he straightens, he catches sight of himself. By coincidence, his boxers are white, and he wears a white T-shirt, as if he, too, is slowly being consumed by some endless nothing. Seeing himself in the mirror in this all-white world, a pale white man draped in white cloth, he considers the possibility that he is a ghost. What is more likely, he wonders, that I swam for miles with a dislocated shoulder and a toddler on my back, or that I drowned in the churning salt like my sister all those years back, her panicked eyes and mouth drawn under the greedy black water of Lake Michigan. Charcoal in hand, he goes around the apartment, turning on lights. There is an instinct to it, a feeling not exactly rational. Outside, he can hear the grinding brakes of the day's first trash truck, its geared jaws pulverizing the things we no longer need.
The apartment now fully illuminated, he turns a slow circle to take it all in. White walls, white furniture, white floors, and this single turn becomes a kind of spin, as if once started, it cannot be stopped. A white cocoon punctuated by black mirrors, window covers raised. Everything capable of producing color has been piled on the low white coffee table. Scott stands with ashen charcoal in hand. He switches the lump from left to right, his eyes drawn to the feral black stain there on his left palm. Then, with gusto, he claps his dirty palm to his chest and draws it down across his belly, smearing black ash onto the cotton. Alive, he thinks. Then he starts on the walls. An hour later, he hears a knock on the door and then the sound of the key in the lock. Layla enters, still dressed for evening in a short gown and high heels. She finds Scott in the living room, throwing beets at the wall. His t-shirt and shorts are ruined in the common parlance, or much improved in the eyes of this particular painter, stained black and red. The air smells vaguely of charcoal and root vegetables. Without acknowledging her arrival, Scott pads over to the wall and crouches, lifting the smashed tuber. Behind him, he hears footsteps in the hall, hears the sound of a breath drawn in, a startled rush. He hears it and doesn't hear it because at the same time, there is nothing but the sound of his own thoughts, visions and memory, and something more abstract, urgent, not in the sense of earth-shattering, but as it feels to urinate finally after a long drive home, stuck in stop-and-go traffic, the long run to the front door, fumbling for keys, fly unbuttoned shakily on the hurried move, and then the artless stream. A biological necessity fulfilled. A light once off, now turned on. The painting is revealing itself to him with every stroke. Behind him, Layla watches, lips parted, taken by a feeling she doesn't really understand. She is an intruder on an act of creation, an unexpected voyeur. This apartment, which she owns and decorated herself, has become something else. Something unexpected and wild. She reaches down and unstraps her high heels, carrying them to the speckled white sofa. "I was at a thing uptown," she says. "One of those endless, who cares, and I saw your light on from the street. All the lights." She sits, one leg folded under the other. Scott runs his hand through his hair, his scalp now the color of cooked lobster. Then he goes to the coffee table, chooses a lipstick. "A 50-year-old man said he wanted to smell my panties," she says. "Or wait, that's not it. He wanted me to take off my panties and slip them into his pocket, and then later, when his wife was sleeping, he said he would hold them to his nose and jerk off into the sink." She unfolds and walks to the liquor cabinet to pour herself a drink. Seemingly oblivious, Scott tests the lipstick color on the wall, then recaps it, chooses a different shade. "Imagine his wide eyes when I told him I wasn't wearing any," Layla says, watching him select a color called Summer Blush. She sips her drink. "Do you ever wonder what things were like before?"
"Before what?" says Scott, not turning.
She lies back on the sofa. "I worry sometimes," she says, "that people only talk to me because I'm rich, or they want to fuck me." Scott is a laser beam, focused on a spot.
"Sometimes," he says, "they're probably just wondering, do you want to order an appetizer or potentially a cocktail?"
"I'm not talking about if it's their job. I'm saying in a room full of people. I'm saying socially or at a business meeting. I'm talking about somebody looking at me and thinking, there's a human being with something meaningful to add to the great debate."
Scott caps the lipstick and steps back to inspect his work. "When I was 7, he says, I ran away from home. I mean not from home, but from the house. I climbed a tree in the backyard. This'll show them, I thought, for who remembers what reason. My mom, from the kitchen window, saw me up there, a boy in the bough of a tree with his knapsack and a pillow, glaring. But she just went about making dinner. Later, I watched them eating at the kitchen table. Mom, Dad, my sister. Pass the biscuits. After the dishes were done, they sat on the sofa watching TV. Real people. Possibly Full House. I started getting cold. He smudges charcoal, perfecting an effect. Have you ever tried sleeping in a tree? He asks. You have to be a panther. One by one, the house lights go out. I'd forgotten to bring food is the thing, or a sweater. So after a while, I climb down and go inside. The back door is open. My mother has left a plate of food on the table for me with a note. Ice cream in the freezer. I sit and eat in the dark, then go upstairs to bed.
What are you saying?
Nothing. It's just something I did. He smudges charcoal lines on the drywall, adding shadows. Or maybe, he says, what I mean is, people can say all kinds of things without ever opening their mouths. She stretches her arms and legs away from her body, turning her hip to the ceiling.
They're saying on the news that the boy stopped talking, she says, that he hasn't spoken a word since the accident. I don't know how they know, but that's what they're saying.
Scott scratches his face, leaving an inky smudge on his temple. When I was drinking, he says, I was what they call a motor mouth. Just one thing after another, mostly the things I thought people wanted to hear or... That's not true. Things I thought were provocative. The truth.
What was your drink?
Whiskey.
So male.
He uncaps the yellow highlighter, rubs the wet felt absently across his left thumb. The day I sobered up, I stopped talking, he says. What was there to say? You need hope to form a thought. It takes, I don't know, optimism to speak, to engage in conversation. Because really, what's the point of all this communicating? What difference does it really make what we say to each other? Or what we do, for that matter?
There's a name for that, she says. It's called depression.
He puts the highlighter down, turns slowly, taking in the work. Shape and color, open to interpretation. He feels exhausted all of a sudden, now that the room has depth, dimension. As his eyes reach Layla, he sees she has removed her dress and is lying naked on the sofa. You weren't kidding about the underwear, he says. She smiles.
All night I was so happy, she says, knowing I had a secret. Everybody talking about what happened, the mystery, a plane crashed. Was it terrorism, some kind of kill-the-rich, beginning-of-the-end scenario, or some North Korean mosquito swat to keep Kipling from narking? You should have been there. But then things turn, become more personal. All these moneyed elitists talking about the boy... Will he ever talk again?
She studies him.
Talking about you.
Scott goes to the kitchen sink, washes his hands, watching ash and lipstick run down the drain. When he comes back, the sofa is empty.
In here,
she calls from the bedroom.
Scott thinks about that.
What a naked woman in his bed will lead to. Then he turns and goes into the study. The walls here are still white. It offends his sense of accomplishment, so he presses his stained torso to the drywall, leaving a body shape like Wile E. Coyote. He goes over to the desk and picks up the phone. Did I wake you? He asks when she answers.
No, says Eleanor. We're up. He had a nightmare.
Scott pictures the boy tossing and turning, the inside of his head a raging sea. What's he doing right now?
Eating cereal. I tried to get him back to sleep, but he wouldn't have it.
So I found Word World on PBS.
Can I talk to him?
He hears her put down the phone, hears the muffled sound of her voice,
JJ,
across the room. Surrendering to gravity, Scott lies on the floor, the phone cord stretching along with him. After a second, he hears the plastic of the receiver dragged across a hard surface, then breathing.
Hey, pal, says Scott.
He waits.
It's Scott. Looks like we both woke up, huh? You had a bad dream?
From the other room, Scott hears Layla turn on the TV, mainlining the 24-hour news cycle. Through the phone, he hears the little boy breathing.
I was thinking about maybe coming up there to see you, says Scott. You could show me your room or... I don't know. It's been hot here, in the city. Your aunt says you're near the river. I could maybe teach you how to skip stones or...
He thinks about what he has just said. Let's you and I visit another large body of water. Part of him wonders if the boy screams every time the toilet flushes, if he shies from the sound of the filling tub.
What helps me with fear, he says, being afraid, is preparation, you know? Knowing how to do things. Like if a bear attacks, they say you're supposed to play dead. Did you know that?
He feels the weight of exhaustion pulling on him from deep below the floor.
What about lions?
The boy says.
Well, says Scott, I'm not sure there. But I tell you what, I'll get the answer and tell you when I see you, okay?
A long silence.
Okay,
says the boy. Scott hears the boy drop the phone, then the sound of its retrieval.
Wow,
says Eleanor.
I don't know what to...
It hangs between them, this miracle worker exchange. Scott doesn't want to talk about it. The fact that the boy will speak to him and no one else is simply a fact, as far as he's concerned, without what psychologists call meaning.
I told him I'd visit, says Scott. Is that okay?
Of course, we'd like that. Scott thinks about the inflection of her voice.
What about your husband? He asks.
There are very few things he likes.
You?
A pause.
Sometimes.
They think about that for a while. From the bedroom, Scott hears a sigh, but he can't tell if it's a human noise or a sound effect off the screen.
Okay, says Scott. Sun'll be up soon. Try to get a nap today.
Thanks,
she says.
Have a nice day.
A nice day. The simplicity of it makes him smile.
You too, he says.
After they hang up, Scott lies there for a beat, flirting with sleep, then climbs to his feet. He follows the sound of the television, peeling off his T-shirt and dropping it on the floor, then takes off his boxers and walks to the bedroom, turning off lights as he goes. Layla is half under the covers, posing hip up. She knows what she looks like, the power of it. Her eyes arranged coyly on the screen. Chilly now, Scott climbs into bed. Layla turns off the TV. Outside, the sun is just starting to rise. He lays his head on the pillow, feeling first her hands and then her body move toward him. Waves climbing a white sand beach. She arranges herself across his hips and torso. Her lips find his neck. Scott feels the warmth of the comforter pulling him down. The white box has been vanquished. Limbo is now a place. Her hand touches his chest. Her leg floats up along his shin and settles across his thighs. Her body is hot, the arc of her breasts flush against his arm. She nuzzles and whispers into the groove of his neck, taking her time.
You like talking to me, she says. Right?
But he is already asleep. Painting number 4. At first it looks like a blank canvas.
a long white rectangle covered in gesso. But stepping closer, you can see there's a topography to the white, shadows and valleys. White paint has been built up in layers, and there are hints of colors underneath, the blush of something hidden. And you think, maybe the canvas isn't blank after all. Maybe the image has been covered, erased by white. The truth is, the naked eye alone will never be able to uncover the story. But if you take your hand and run it over the valleys and ridges of gesso, if you close your eyes and allow the topographic truth to seep through, then maybe the contours of a scene begin to leak through. Flames. The outline of a building. Your imagination does the rest. Public, private. A car horn wakes him, long and insistent. Layla is gone. The horn comes again. Scott gets to his feet, walks naked to the window. There is a news crew outside, satellite van parked on the curb, dish deployed. They have found him. He steps back from the curtain, finds the remote, turns on the television. The image of a house appears, a white three-story with blue windows and black stars on a tree-lined street in New York City. It is the house he's standing in. A news scroll slides along under the house, displaying words and numbers. The NASDAQ, down 13 points. Dow Jones, up 116. On the left-hand side of the screen, Bill Cunningham occupies his own box, leaning into the lens. He's shacking up, apparently, with the famous radical heiress whose father gave over $400 million to lefty causes last year. You remember, dear viewers, the man who tried to buy the 2012 election? Well, this is his little girl. Although, not so little anymore. Look at these pictures of her from a film festival in France earlier this year. On screen, the house slides to a smaller box, replaced in the main window by still images of Layla in a series of revealing ball gowns, clipped from style sheets and scandal rags. There is a bikini shot, long-lensed from an actor's yacht. Scott wonders if Layla is in the house watching this. As if hearing his thoughts, the apartment door opens. Layla comes in. She is dressed for a day of meetings, it appears.
I didn't tell anyone, she says. I swear.
Scott shrugs. He never assumed she did. In his mind, they are both an endangered species discovered mid-molt by a curious child with poor impulse control. On screen, he watches 15 curtained windows, a narrow front door painted blue, two garage doors also blue. The only thing shading his safe house from view is a narrow sapling, just a stick, really, with a half-hearted spray of green leaves. Scott studies the house he's in on TV, concerned, but also strangely fascinated, like a man watching himself being eaten alive. It seems he cannot avoid becoming a public figure now, that he must participate in this commercial dance. How strange, he thinks. Layla stands beside him. She is thinking about saying more, but doesn't. After a moment, she turns and wanders out of the apartment again. Scott hears the apartment door close, then the sound of her heels on the staircase. He stands staring at the house on television. Bill Cunningham, looking energized, says,
"Movement in an upstairs window just moments ago. Sources tell us that Mrs. Mueller lives in the house alone, which, how many bedrooms are there, dear viewers? Looks like at least six to me. And I can't help but make some connections here. The head of a conservative news network dies in mysterious circumstances, and then the lone survivor of the plane crash shacks up with the daughter of a left-wing activist. Well, some people might call it a coincidence, but I do not."
On screen, one of the garage doors starts to open. Scott leans forward, watching more than just television now. He half expects to see himself pull out, but instead, a black Mercedes emerges, Layla behind the wheel wearing oversized sunglasses. The news cameras move in, looking to block her way, but she pulls out quickly, more than willing to run them over, and makes a left turn, roaring off up Bank Street toward Greenwich before they can pen her in.
In her wake, the garage door closes.
The homeowner, definitely.